from WXXI News. This is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm host Devin Dawson.
And I'm producer Megan Mack. We open the week by welcoming a local doctor, Alexander Strasser. He's in his 80s, and while he considers himself an American and a Rochesterian now, his roots go back to Europe. Alex and his family escaped the Nazis, who were pursuing Jewish refugees across Europe in 1939 and 1940.
Ken Burns tells the story in his newest documentary called Defying the Nazis, which aired this past week on WXXI-TV. Dr. Strasser and his brother Joseph are featured. In studio with us, he answered a question about whether another figure like Hitler could rise to power again. Could another Hitler rise today?
In Germany or anywhere?
Anywhere.
Absolutely, yes. When times are tough, when there is discussion over race and religion, and when people get desperate, and someone comes up with an easy answer, another Hitler could rise. We are more protected here than Germany is because we have traditions of democracy, and we have in place Congress, Supreme Court, and other things that the Germans don't have. But could a demagogue come over in Germany or United States and duplicate what Hitler did? Yes. We must be on guard for people who are looking for an easy answer to problems of the day by saying, we will take over, we will show you the path to greatness, to food, to happiness. We must be very careful in listening to that and see how possibly could they do this.
Easy answers sound great to many people when there are problems, but in a complex world, you're saying don't buy the charismatic person who has an easy answer for every problem.
I totally agree with that, Evan. There is behind this a lot, and I will not get into politics and names, but it's easy as a politician to say X, Y, Z, but we have to look why he says X, Y, Z, and what's behind the X, Y, Z.
And another listener named Mary says, what a lovely guest you have today. I'm curious to know how his life in America has been. Has he suffered any discrimination here?
I've enjoyed my many years in America, and my wife and I, and my wife is, by the way, not Jewish, she's Protestant. Mm-hmm. And that has never been a problem between us. We've done very well, but have I suffered discrimination in a mild form? Yes. No one hit me on the head. No one threw stones. But I do remember as a child being called sorts of names because I was Jewish.
Then we had the chance to talk to actor Richard Dreyfuss. The Academy Award winner is coming to Rochester to speak at the annual East House Hope and Recovery Luncheon. Dreyfuss was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in the 1970s.
He spoke to WXXI News director Randy Gorman about his career and his life with the disorder.
I take an occasional pill for anxiety, and it took me years to stop feeling like I was scamming my doctors and trying to, you know, get them to give me what I wanted. And one day my doctor looked up to me and said, I am your doctor, I am not your dealer. And he gave me what he thought he should. And then he also said this, which is one of the greatest lines I've ever heard. About a year later, and I'm in my 40s now, I said to him one day, you know, you can consider us a success story because I'm a different person than I was before, and I have a lot more courage, and I owe you that. And he looked at me and said, it isn't courage I give you. It's an absence of anxiety. And I thought that was one of the greatest compliments I'd ever received because I was, at that time, acting very courageously in my career and in my politics and stuff and in my family. And to realize what he meant was that's your natural state. You just had anxiety to pull you back. And I thought that was a wonderful, wonderful compliment. Everyone thinks that there's shame involved, that you have to hide and come out of the closet, and you're filled with shame and worthlessness and all of this. But I guarantee you that the person who is the patient and who may be suffering far beyond what I'm feeling, they have to be helped. But there really is at the basis no difference between the patient and anybody who is there, doctors, nurses, everyone. In our normal day, you run across personalities. Some of them are your boss, so you have to suck it up. Some of them are your wife, and you have to deal with it openly. And your kids, which are almost impossible to deal with because you love them so much and you don't want anything bad to happen to them. And it's terrifying. But I'm really coming to offer another vision, which is that this is a medical mental condition that you can take advantage of. I remember one doctor saying to me, "Richard, somewhere in your brain there is a faucet that is dripping either too slowly or too quickly, and we can help you." And I'll never forget the feeling of relief that just swept over me.
Dreyfus will give the keynote address at the East House Luncheon next Friday, September 30th, in Rochester. It's no secret that Rochester has a serious poverty problem. This week, we learned that it's grown even worse in the past year. More kids live in poverty in Rochester than any other city of its size. There's more extreme poverty. And now more than one-third of all Rochester residents live in poverty.
Interestingly, if you look at an entire region that we're in, our poverty level is pretty much national average. So even while poverty numbers are growing in the suburbs, it is nothing like the level of urban poverty. We talked to the man who has written the poverty reports, Ed Doherty, who says we're not going to conquer this problem unless we all care about what happens in our cities.
I do not see that we have a poverty problem per se. If we look at the nine-county region, our poverty rate is lower than the national average. It is only when we look at the dramatic concentration of poverty in the city that we get numbers where we are still the fifth poorest city in the country and the second poorest city of our size, and have the highest poverty rate among children of any city our size. Those facts are driven entirely by the extreme concentration of poverty that we have in this community. It's more extraordinary than exists in most communities, and it has a big effect. It's not only shows up in the numbers, but it affects what goes on in our schools, it affects what goes on in our communities, and it's really the biggest challenge I think that we have, is to not just look at poverty and how we find some solutions to poverty, but how we find some solutions to this issue of our dramatic concentration.
All right, so 37 neighborhoods of extreme poverty versus 27 in 2010. Do we have a good handle at all on why?
Well, you know, we didn't repeat it in this study, but the first study spent a fair amount of time looking at the way in which Rochester developed as a community and looked at issues of racial segregation, which even today, as we use current numbers, we are a considerably more segregated community than most other cities. So that's the fact that first comes to my mind, our legacy as well as our continued patterns of segregation. The approach to sprawl, or the non-approach to sprawl that we have taken. We've had sort of virtually unmanaged sprawl in this metropolitan area, and that's resulted in a significant change in the way in which income has been distributed geographically around the region. Again, that happens in most cities, but it has been extraordinary in the degree here. We also have a very restrictive reality when it comes to housing. People of low income, especially families of low income, and that shows up in this new report in a very dramatic way. Families of low income have very, very few choices in terms of where they are able to live, in terms of the availability of rental property at all, and especially the availability of rental property that has the kind of subsidies that are necessary for people of very low income. And so you have those kinds of practices, you have those kinds of realities, you're going to get a dramatic concentration. We've never developed any policies that I'm aware of to address this, and I think that that's coming home to show itself.
We're coming off one of the hottest and driest summers ever in Western New York. We're in a drought, and parts of the Finger Lakes region are in severe drought, as classified in several different ways. Journalist Matt Kelly wrote about the impact on regional farms, which will generally have less to offer this fall. That could mean higher prices at your local farm market or grocery store.
So what can we do to help? Here's Matt Kelly answering that question, and then you'll hear from Klaus Martens, an organic farmer in Penn Yan.
I think it's also extremely important for consumers to understand the realities of farming and understanding what each of us can do, both with the choices we make and with our pocketbooks, to continue to support farmers who are doing the job of feeding us. You know, it's one thing to say, well, the government should just cover them. That's all fine and good. But it's another thing to say, hey, you know what? I might look at some different varieties. I might look at buying some different types of produce. I might understand when things aren't in the store. I might be willing to pay a little bit more. I know that's kind of a tough conversation. Nobody wants to pay more for anything, but farmers are doing a hard job that the majority of Americans don't do. And if, you know, if we're happy with the food they're sending our way, we need to be out there supporting it in any way we can.
If you and your family can afford it, it means a lot to farmers for you to stick by them in tough times. I mean, Klaus, what do you, from the farming perspective, what do you say to consumers who are going to be looking at prices, are going to be trying to understand the drought and ways that they can support farming?
This is more of a general thing, but I would say to be more adventurous with what we eat. Because if we're going to have more diversity on farms, you know, I'm preaching to farmers saying you've got to have more diversity, and they're going to come right back and say, well, where am I going to sell this extra diversity? I've been in quite a few meetings where I'm challenged with the idea of, well, organic farming can't feed the world, and I'll always come back saying that is absolutely not true, with one caveat. It would not be a diet of high fructose corn sweetener and hydrogenated soy meal. It would have to be a diet that's much more diverse than the one that we're currently eating.
Let's close the week with a little satire. Author Malcolm Gladwell recently declared that American satire is basically dead. He says it's toothless, ineffective, cowering to power. And as an example, he pointed at Tina Fey as Sarah Palin on Saturday Night Live. Here's a clip from the first time Tina Fey played Palin, alongside, in a sketch, Amy Poehler, who was playing Hillary Clinton.
But tonight we are crossing party lines to address the now very ugly role that sexism is playing in the campaign. An issue which I am frankly surprised to hear people suddenly care about. You know, Hillary and I don't agree on everything.
Anything. I believe that diplomacy should be the cornerstone of any foreign policy.
And I can see Russia from my house.
I believe global warming is caused by man.
And I believe it's just God hugging us closer.
So what's the problem? Gladwell says Tina Fey is a comic genius, but her satire fails. Here's why.
I can't help but think that her comic genius is actually a problem. SNL brought Tina Fey in to skewer Palin out of a sense of outrage that someone this unqualified was running for higher office. In 2008, lots of people felt this way. Palin was the running mate of John McCain, an elderly senator of uncertain health. She could easily have been president. SNL was trying to hold Sarah Palin to some kind of scrutiny, to say, this is who she is. But looking back now, I don't think it worked. Because Tina Fey is too busy being funny.
Our panel of guests from the local comedy and theater scene thought Gladwell was wrong, that Tina Fey's portrayal of Palin did, in fact, affect public sentiment. And generally, they think American satire can still be pretty effective. Here's what Carrie Young said alongside Tim Ryan. Carrie is a local director, producer, actor, and writer. And Tim is with Jiva Comedy Improv. Carrie Young, did it work? Do you agree with Gladwell, or do you think he's wrong here?
I don't agree with that particular point. I think he goes on to say that her charisma washes over the point, and I feel like if we don't want actors and performers to have some charisma and to bring forth a personality that's incredibly magnetic, then why even put them on in the first place? So I don't think that her talent and her charisma and her genius overshadowed the point in any way, shape, or form. I feel like she brought that forth amazingly well.
Okay, Tim?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with Carrie on this. You know, as a performer, I think you walk a fine line in really not alienating your audience, you know, and in that particular circumstance, you don't want to alienate those folks that are strong Palin supporters if the whole point of satire is to change their minds, right? So if she went in harder, let's say, and was maybe a little more offensive or what have you, and to the point where those diehard supporters shut down. So I think, you know, when you're approaching that sort of a task, you need to walk that line and gradually bring your audience along on that journey that will hopefully, you know, eventually change their mindset.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and on WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
And you can find us on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack.
Feel better this weekend,
Thank you.
Megan Mack.
Sorry,
I'm Evan
listeners.
Dawson. No problem. I'm Evan Dawson. We're going to talk with you on Monday.